The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast. I'm Brian Curtis, along with Doug Krisner. Join us each day for the stories making news and moving markets in the Asia Pacific. You can subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Let's get to Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. He's in Washington, D.C., aiming to strengthen ties with the United States. Joining us for a closer look is Bloomberg's Isabel Reynolds, our Tokyo bureau chief from our studios in the Japanese capital. Good of you to join us, Isabel. I'm curious to begin with, how much of the focus do you think is going to be on boosting ties against a resurgent China?
Oh, yes, I think that's very much going to be the overarching theme of this particular bilateral meeting. We already know from pre-briefings from the U.S. Side that what they're going to talk about is things like having their militaries work more closely together, setting up this defense council, which will look into defense procurement and how they can work more closely together on that, and even having Japanese shipyard workers work on U.S. naval vessels, which will be a new development, and very much showing that in terms of the military and security, there's no daylight between the two of them, and they're going to, you know, work ever more closely together.
So that's one important angle. The other angle that we've been championing this morning is the Japanese Prime Minister calling for increased U.S. investment in Japan. Is that something relatively new? I mean, you would think that they would always be pressing for that. But I guess at this time where you're talking about artificial intelligence and high levels of tech and keeping China at bay, it takes on new importance.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I think Japan does have concerns about being left behind in these kind of issues, on these new development areas, and seeing that the U.S. is kind of surging ahead. It's trying to sort of catch up on the coattails there. And we saw this huge investment from Microsoft, $2.9 billion into Japan, which it will be marked up as a good success for Kishida on this particular visit. Business ties are always a theme of these visits, but I think one of the reasons why it's more of a focus this time also is because of the whole Nippon Steel fuss. You know, why is the U.S. so concerned about an ally investing in one of their companies? And I think Kishida is very concerned to try and make it plain that, you know, hey, we both invest in each other's countries. This is healthy. This is beneficial. There's nothing to fear here.
But it's also an election year for President Biden. And in Pennsylvania particularly, I think he has to pay attention to what the United Steelworkers are saying. That's a fair thing. Can you think the Prime Minister can understand that idea?
Oh, yes, very much so. I think the Japanese do understand. And that's why, from our understanding from Japanese officials, Kishida won't even be raising it directly with the president. So what he's going to do instead is go and visit this Toyota factory in North Carolina, according to media reports. And that will sort of, in a more subtle way, underscore the point, look, we've been doing this for a long time. We've been investing in the U.S. for a long time. It's creating jobs. We've created a million jobs in the U.S. So you should be welcoming us.
I like the job as a journalist. You get to ask dumb questions and be proud of it. I'm curious, Isabel, from your long stay in Japan, about Japanese opinions of America, and also from what you know about, you know, because this Nippon Steel, it doesn't sit very well in one sense. How do Americans view Japan at the moment?
How do Americans view Japan at the moment?
Well, both.
Well, both ways. Right. Yeah, I mean, I think most people who are looking at this issue, I mean, I'm not necessarily sure that the person on the street would know about this Nippon Steel deal and what's going on. But for the people who do, I think they understand the electoral situation. They know how sort of toxic and, very divided the atmosphere can become before a U.S. election. So they're not necessarily sort of blaming America or seeing it as undermining the relationship as a whole. But I think that there is a slight concern about how this might portray the relationship outside the two countries. So how will China portray this if the two of them are perceived to be, you know, in conflict over this issue?
One of the things that I was struck by, too, is the Biden administration enacted very recently an unexpected moratorium on liquefied natural gas. Help me understand, because Japan is a big energy importer. Did this come as a big surprise to Japan?
Yes. Well, what we've been told is that Japan was not told in advance that this announcement was coming. So it must have been a very big shock to Japan, which is very reliant on LNG. And the U.S. has been one of its big sources in recent years. So that has been raised at Kishida's meetings with business executives already. It's something that he wants to continue to work on. And I think that is something that he will raise with Biden this time, because that's not something, it's not just one individual company, it's Japan's economy as a whole that relies on these sources of energy. So he can't afford to let that one slide.
So we've talked about the military angle. Oh, I wanted to ask you briefly, Australia came out yesterday and said, well, yes, but Japan would not be formally invited to join AUKUS. What's the issue there?
Right. Yes. I think there are a number of issues going on. I think possibly there's a difference in temperature between the US and the Australia and the UK on this issue. One issue is that obviously the first pillar of AUKUS has not been going very smoothly. There's been a delay in the production of submarines, which was the first purpose of AUKUS. So I think from some people's point of view, bringing someone else and moving on into other projects doesn't really make sense when you're not getting on very well with your initial project. So I don't think it's any kind of alienation towards Japan. I think it's more about what's the most efficient way to get on with these projects.
Isabel, before we let you go, I have to ask about how well Prime Minister Kishida is performing at home. What do we know about what the polls are saying about Kishida's popularity?
It's worse than it's ever been. He's had these massive scandals over the past few months, kind of through no fault of his own, but he's perceived as having failed to sort of clamp down on them. And now that he's belatedly tried to do that, it's had no effect on public opinion. And the latest polls show him at, I think, 23% in the NHK poll, which is the lowest since he took office.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you for making time to chat with us. Isabel Reynolds there, Bloomberg's Tokyo Bureau Chief, joining us from our studios in the Japanese capital.
Can I mention something that would make us both feel old?
Yeah, what?
Can you believe, I mean, Paul Simon is going to play for Kishida.
Oh,
Paul,
man.
Paul Simon's 82. Does that make you feel old?
Yes.
I mean, surprising.
Yeah. I'm not unreal. Quite there yet, but I'm not far behind.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
We have a few minutes to spend with Mark Konen, CIO of AIA Group, and kind of legend here in Hong Kong from the fund industry. Mark, thanks very much for coming into our studios. It's been a pretty good environment for risk assets here over the past many months. It hasn't been without a wall of worry to climb, for sure. A lot of people are concerned about whether or not inflation is now rearing its ugly head. Before we get into, specific questions here and there, just give me your overall feel about the climate at the moment.
In terms of investing, I think still leaning into the rally in risk assets. Concerns, obviously, that the U.S. economy is running a little too hot. But in the short term, that will play into the hands of those who are willing to take the risk and to benefit from equity markets.
So does that mean you want to be more exposed at this point to the U.S. and Japan, let's say, and underweight China?
Well, we're certainly constructive still on the U.S. We see a broadening out of the market as we get beyond the Magnificent Seven, and there are reasons to believe that that is already underway. Japan, we are positive as well. We see some opportunities there as the economy continues to make progress and headway. China, we've cut out underweight And we are starting to see the sort of so-called early green shoots of some form of recovery. We've got a little bit of fiscal support, but it's meager in the context of what's required. And we see tremendous overhang of the problems in the property sector, which are causing a depletion in consumption confidence. So although we're seeing some movement, we're seeing a little bit of revision of earnings up, it's a little bit early to be calling a big overweight on China.
We had a long-standing South Korean discount where investors had some other considerations to a certain degree with South Korea vis-a-vis North Korea. In China, it seems like we've kind of adopted now a something of a Chinese discount. You mentioned some of the more kind of tangible issues, the property crisis, slowdown in the economy, difficulty coming out of COVID and all that. But there is also this kind of regulatory overhang in that discount. How permanent is that China discount?
Well, it's a bit of disaster myopia, where the further you get away from that period of intense uncertainty, the more confidence will be built up internationally. And we're still too close to when that occurred for international investors yet to be convinced that things are more stable. But great efforts are being made on the mainland to portray a position of increased stability. We saw Janet Yellen recently there and provide some indication that there's a move towards normalcy in the bilateral relationship between the two countries. Similarly, we've had a lot of visitors through Hong Kong in the last week or so attending international investor conferences, and there seems to be some sense that China is now worth a look. We've seen the southbound allocations coming out of China as positive. It's good to see them, the resumption of those flows. And as I say, we're starting to see some earnings improvement in the internet sector and in manufacturing, less so elsewhere. And our focus really is on, at this point, in a prolonged recovery on the state-owned enterprises that are likely to benefit from being aligned with where the policy is heading.
Mark, as you know, next week we get the monthly activity data, and I'm particularly interested in the print on retail sales. What is your sense right now of where Chinese consumers stand?
Very depleted in terms of confidence. You know, the blow that many people suffered in the urban areas during the pandemic, coming out of the pandemic, and then uncertainty around policy, the confusion around geopolitics, the weakness on the currency, the deflation, the cut in rates, all of these have compounded upon sentiment. And I think it's going to take a little bit longer for people to recover from that and for us to see a significant improvement within consumption. That's at an aggregate level. But of course, within that picture, there are those that are prospering, that are able to offer a relative advantage and are continuing to make progress. But as I say, from an equity point of view, it's much more focused now on manufacturing and internet plays.
In the past, we saw the Chinese consumers spend rather vigorously abroad, particularly in Europe with luxury items. I'm not sure that the Chinese consumer is ready to take on the same sort of mantle that the American consumer has in terms of powering the economy. But is that out there for the future at some point in China?
Well, that's certainly the way in which policy was being framed prior to the pandemic, that the dependency on low-cost manufacturers, the need to move up the value chain, meant that a shift towards greater dependency on domestic activity, domestic consumption, was going to replace that dependency on the export markets. Exports so far this year have surprised on the upside for China, as we've seen. You know, the rest of the world has perhaps continued to grow more vigorously than was expected. China has benefited from that. But that transition towards more of a domestic focus for the economy is certainly a long-term policy aim. But I think in the near term, until confidence recovers, we're not going to see a significant move in that direction.
And how's Mark Conan's confidence at the moment?
Still looking for catalysts to move back vigorously into equity markets across the region. Of course, Taiwan and Korea have benefited from this big AI push, and other economies in the region will benefit later on in the year as a result.
All right, Mark, thank you very much for joining us here live in our studios. Mark Conan, CIO of AIA Group, with us here in Hong Kong. This is Bloomberg.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
We talked about the Fed. We talked about the CPI report coming out tomorrow morning in the United States and how this might affect markets. Joining us for some discussion of that is Daniel Lamb, head of equity strategy at Standard Chartered Wealth Solutions. Daniel, inflation has gone from 9% to 3%, and the Fed funds rate has stayed at 5.5%. Now, the Fed knows a change needs to come at some point in the near future, but it's a little worried about optics. Should it be?
Well, they are concerned ultimately about a repeat of what happened in the 1980s, right? Because they did, that time they did cut prematurely, and then inflation came back in a big way. So, you know, I do believe that they would need to be, you know, treading cautious water here. And while they really want to cut rates, they need to be really watching out for inflation to come off more decisively before they can, you know, possibly cut rates.
I was shocked this morning when I opened my Bloomberg and discovered that State Street was making a call for a 50 basis point rate cut as soon as June. And the chief investment officer at the firm was saying there is a lot to suggest that this is still a very fragile economy. Yes, it has signs of being resilient on the surface, but maybe there's something more going on under the hood that should be concerning. Do you share that perspective? I mean, is there something that that you may be worried about under the surface of economic activity?
Not that I'm aware of. I do believe that the economy is actually, you know, quite resilient, judging from, you know, the rebound in the ISM and also, you know, the strong NFP numbers. So, you know, if I were to pick sides, I would think that it would be cutting probably somewhere between 2 to 3 times or even less, tilting towards the 2-time cut. You know, that's where I would stand for this year.
So we often hear questions to guests, you know, well, what happens if the Fed only cuts, you know, one time instead of three? You know, that's got to be a negative, right? Well, that's just one input, right? If you have growth stronger than we thought, and if you have earnings stronger than we thought, and companies more efficient in their operations, that's three positives to go with one negative. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to consider the math in this. You can't just keep saying that if rates don't go down, oh, that's a game changer, right?
Correct. And I do agree with that. I believe that while, you know, investors are powering back on, you know, this expectations of rate cuts, there could be some volatility in the market, but it would probably be some rotation within the sectors, right? I mean, net on the headline S&P 500, perhaps some mild pullback, but nothing major. You will get some opportunities, you know, in the growth sectors because the earnings expectations is really high. So they could pull back, you know, sometime later in this quarter. That's entirely possible. And given the, you know, situation, the rate cuts, yeah, that's possible. And then the money is probably going to be rotating into the more traditional sectors, you know, like industrials and also like energy. Okay. So you could see that.
So what are clients in Asia saying to you about where they want to be exposed right now? Are they exploring the opportunities that may be presented in China? I mean, given the fact that valuations are so tremendously low, and if you want to do your homework, maybe on a company-by-company basis, there are opportunities. Are people saying that to you?
Yes. People are looking at the state-owned enterprises with high dividend yields in China because the high dividend yield would give them, you know, some sort of return, and also the fact that the government is encouraging the management of the state-owned enterprises to boost the market capitalization. And that was announced 2 months ago, and so far the SOEs have been doing pretty well. Of course, you know, given uncertainties in the on the tax side of things, that, you know, is an extra plus for the state-owned enterprises.
So it's a great program, I think, for us to talk about, you know, areas that maybe don't get mentioned all that much. So key ways of unlocking value. I had a guest tell me yesterday that look for companies that own businesses in India that have really, really grown. Mm-hmm. And it actually, in some cases, the business in India is about the same size as the home business, the parent business back home. And it's just kind of a way to find unlocked value. Give me an idea of Daniel Lam's approach to finding something that others don't know.
Well, the India story is certainly something to look at. You know, the market is, there's the long-term pluses, right? Long-term pluses, because one of the biggest difference between India and the other markets is the demographics, right? Demographics is actually very favorable. 70% of the working population, of the population is in the, on the working side.
Young people like
you. Young people. Yeah, so those, India is certainly looking good. I would say that Korea market is following the footsteps of Japan. That's also very important to watch because they are having this value up program. You know, you've seen how well Japan has done over the last 2 years. So that could be the next up, right?
All right. All right, Daniel. Out of time, unfortunately. I'll get you back soon. Thanks very much for joining us. Daniel Lam, head of equity strategy at Standard Chartered Wealth Solutions.
This has been the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast, bringing you the stories making news and moving markets in the Asia Pacific. Visit the Bloomberg podcast channel on YouTube to get more episodes of this and other shows from Bloomberg. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.